locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owen's Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. Just a moment here, as soon as we get set up with our guest, we'll be talking about a landmark legal case, one that took place in England back in the 1770s, that a lot of people regard as being something of the beginning of the end of slavery in England and the United States. It is a case that presents, of course, very compelling issues, some rather interesting personalities, and we'll talk about it here this morning with a guest, Stephen Wise, who's authored a book on the subject. His book is titled Though the Heavens May Fall, and the subtitle is The Landmark Trial That Led to the End of Human Slavery. It is out now, recently published by Da Capo Press. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest, Stephen Wise. He's taught at a number of law schools, Harvard, Vermont, and John Marshall. He's also president of the Center for the Expansion of Fundamental Rights, which he founded in 1995. He is the author of another book that we discussed, in fact, here on this program, a book titled Rattling the Cage, which takes a look at law and animals. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana, or in fact, if you would happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States. Any and all of those kinds of listeners are welcome to use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-9455 for people here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Wise, hello.
Hello, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing very well.
Good. Thanks very much for talking with us. Well, let's talk a little bit, I guess, to start about the man who is really at the center of this case, a man named James Somerset, who was born in Africa, and when he was a boy, was captured. He was sold into slavery. He was purchased by a man named Charles Stewart, living in Virginia, and did live in Virginia for a number of years. How is it that the two of them ended up in London in the 1770s, where this trial took place?
Well, Charles Stewart was a Scotsman who lived in Virginia, and he ended up saving some Spanish passengers on a ship once, interfering with a mob who was trying to kill them, and for that he was promoted to a high position in the British customs. Then he was ultimately promoted to the highest customs official in England, and I'm sorry, in the Americas, and ultimately he decided to take a rest and go to London in 1771. I'm sorry, in 1770. And when he did that, he naturally brought along his most trusted manservant and slave, who was James Somerset. So the two of them ended up in 1770 living together in London.
Hmm. So then here they are in London. And so then what happens is that James Somerset runs away. He leaves.
Yes, he escaped, and indeed there were about 15,000 blacks in England at the time, and most of them were concentrated in London, and there was a substantial number of runaways, and there had a very flourishing community, and he apparently joined that community and wanted to live his own life, and he was on his own for somewhat less than 60 days before the slave catchers that his master, Charles Stewart, put on him, managed to catch up with him and drag him off to a ship in the Thames Harbor to be brought to be sold again on the slave markets in Jamaica.
So they caught him. They took him to the ship. Rather than taking him back, Stewart puts him on the ship to be sold.
Yes, Stewart was very angry, apparently. They had a quite close relationship, and Stewart had trusted Somerset for more than 20 years, and indeed Somerset had spent a lot of time on his own. Stewart would tell him to travel from city to city, both within London and within the United States, and Somerset would do it without escaping. So when he did, Stuart was furious, and apparently Somerset may have said some things to Stuart as he was leaving that absolutely enraged Stuart, and so Stuart did not want him back and wanted him sold, and also as a gauge of the depth of betrayal he felt, he knew that slaves who were sold on the slave markets in Jamaica were not going to live for very long.
Yeah. So Stuart, Somerset had escaped. He had been living in this community of runaway slaves. So obviously the word must have gotten out that he, in fact, had been caught by the slave catchers, had been put on this boat, was bound for Jamaica if no one intervened. And, in fact, he was saved. How did that happen?
Well, he had done what many blacks did, which was convert to Christianity, get baptized. And it was partly because there was a myth circulating through the black community and through some of the whites as well that Christians could not be slaves. And it was something that was held even though no court had ever freed a slave on the grounds that he or she had become a Christian and become baptized. But Somerset did get baptized in 1770 and London, and he came up with a number of godfathers. And traditionally, or at least in a few times, godfathers or godparents looked out for the slaves who they were godfathering, and if they tried to escape, would actually help them. And some people think that the people who became Somerset's godfathers in 1770 may have even helped him escape and hidden him, because shortly after he was captured, placed on the ship, but before the ship could sail out of the Thames, somebody went to the Court of King's Bench before Lord Mansfield, who was the greatest judge probably then or any other time in an English-speaking country, and obtained a writ of habeas corpus, which means produce the body. Mm-hmm. And the captain of the Anne and Mary, which was the ship that Somerset was on, was then ordered to stop his ship, bring Somerset before Lord Mansfield, which he did.
Then here as you tell the story, we're introduced to one of the most interesting characters in this whole story, and there are a number of them. And this was a man named Granville Sharp. As once Somerset got free, he went to see Granville Sharp, and the reason that he went to see him is because he was someone who was well known as an abolitionist and had in fact been involved by this time in a couple of other celebrated cases that involved similar sorts of situations in which he was trying to make the argument that slavery was wrong. He believed that it was morally wrong, it was legally wrong, it was against the Bible, and he was looking for cases to use to make that argument. So tell us, who was Granville Sharp?
Granville Sharp was one of those extraordinary people in history who pop up every now and then. He was the fifth or sixth son of a person who ran out of money before he could send Granville to school. So Granville really was a self-educated man. He was intensely religious. He believed in the literal truth of the Bible, and but he hadn't really thought anything at all about slavery. And one day in the mid 1760s, he was in his brother and his brother was a doctor, when he ran into a young black man who was nearly dead. And it turned out that young black man was a slave and had been beaten over the head so repeatedly and so severely by his master, who was using a revolver, that he was nearly dead. And so Granville and his brother William, who was the surgeon, got this slave to the hospital where it took him more than 3 months to recover. When he got out of the hospital, they then got him a job at which he fruitfully worked for the next 2 years. Then by chance, his old master, I'm sure to his astonishment, sees that instead of his former slave having died in the street as he expected, he was now a hale and healthy fellow who was hard at work. So what he did is then sell him to someone else and then arrange to have that slave captured and thrown into a prison called the Poultry Compter. The slave then managed to get word out to Sharp, who had actually forgotten what he had done for the man, because Granville Sharp was a man who thought that his time on earth should be spent doing good deeds for others, and so he did a lot of them. So he had actually forgotten that he had helped the slave. He then went to the jail and was turned away and that made him suspicious, and he ultimately was able to meet the slave, realized who he was, and was horrified that he had been recaptured. He then went to the mayor of London and demanded a hearing as to whether this man could be kept in prison or brought to the West Indies and sold. And at this first real challenge to the legality of slavery, the mayor of London, who also had judicial powers, said that the slave had done nothing wrong and that there was no reason to keep him. At that point, Sharp and another brother were sued by the slave's new master. And Sharp then went to the best lawyers in London and said, I can't be sued because it's not right to have slavery. And all of the lawyers he saw, including the most eminent in England, told him that he was going to lose, that slavery was accepted and legal. And Sharp was the kind of person who said, well, if that's true, then I'm going to study the law myself, and I'm going to see to it that slavery, if it is legal, is not going to be legal because it's wrong, and the law cannot be wrong like this. And that's what he did for the next year or two. He studied the law. He then wrote up his own legal tract about why slavery should be illegal and published it. And ultimately, the lawsuit against him was dropped. But this had awakened Sharp to the outrages of black chattel slavery in England and Africa.
As you say, for a lot of reasons, he was an appealing character, certainly for his very strong feelings about slavery. It seems, though, that in many other ways that he was a rather unappealing character. He definitely seems, as an individual, to have his pluses and minuses.
Well, he was a religious bigot, for one thing. He was a strong supporter of the Church of England, but was as were many in England at the time, was rabidly anti-Catholic. In fact, did not believe that Catholics were even Christians, and he was against people being able to remarry after divorce. He was against males and males playing females on the London stage. He had his own reasons, and when he believed something, he was absolutely immovable. And luckily for slavery in the course of history, one of the things that he believed in was that slavery was wrong, and he was absolutely immovable on that. One of the interesting things is that he was simply a lowly ordnance clerk who worked in the Tower of London many, many hours a day, and he decided that the lawyers of England, the judges of England, everybody was wrong, and that slavery was wrong, and that if they weren't going to make slavery illegal, he was going to make them do it, and he did.
Maybe I should introduce again at this point our guest. For anybody who has tuned in, we're talking with Stephen Wise. He's taught at Harvard, Vermont, John Marshall Law Schools. He's president of the Center for the Expansion of Fundamental Rights and has written widely on the roots of Western law. He is the author of a new book that explores this chapter in legal history, and it is titled Though the Heavens May Fall, The Landmark Trial That Led to the End of Human Slavery. It's published by DeCapo. And questions again are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. The case that first got Granville Sharp involved in this issue that you just gave the thumbnail sketch of, and it concerned this man named Jonathan Strong. After that, there was another case that Sharp was involved in, and this involved a married couple, a couple who had married as slaves. The owners of the man set him free. This couple lived together, and then a couple of years later, the owners of the woman had her kidnapped and shipped. Actually, no one succeeded in rescuing her. She was actually shipped back to slavery in the West Indies. What's the story of that case?
That's the John Hylas case, and indeed that did happen to John Hylas and his wife Mary. And for 2 years, John did not know what to do. His wife had been shipped back to the West Indies, and then he learned of Granville Sharp, and he went to Sharp's door, and he explained his problem, and Sharp got him counsel, and began to think, well, maybe this will be the test case that I want. However, it turns out that John Hylas' lawyers were really not very good. They were not very aggressive, and they were not very learned. And they were so timid that they didn't even, in their court papers, seek to have Mary Hylas brought back to London. Instead, they just asked for monetary damages for John Hylas for losing his wife, which was just one of many times that Granville Sharp became apoplectic about how the legal system was dealing with the whole issue of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
The judge saw past that. This was not Lord Mansfield, but was another very competent judge, and ultimately on his own asked the former slave, John Hylas, well, did he want money or did he want his wife back? And he said he wanted his wife back. So the judge ordered that his wife be brought back within 6 months or by the first available ship back to London. Sharp was still not satisfied because he believed that under a statute that John Hylas should have been able to have his wife back, but should also have been able to have gotten quite substantial damages. It called for a minimum of £500, which was quite a large sum of money for the end of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought that John Hylas had not been dealt with properly, even though he was indeed set to get his wife back.
The next case that you write about, which was sort of the penultimate, the one that we come to just before the case that really is the landmark case that you talk about in the book. Again, it's a similar kind of a story. A black man named Thomas Lewis, again, who had been a slave. Again, he escaped. He was kidnapped. He was put on a ship bound for Jamaica to be sold there. Was rescued at the last minute.
Literally the last
minute. Yeah, literally the last minute. And again, Granville Sharp got involved. And in this particular case, what he and the people that he was working with actually managed to charge Lewis's former owner with kidnapping. And this case actually went to trial, and this is one that it did indeed involve this judge, Lord Mansfield. He was the presiding judge. I should ask you to talk a little bit about who this man was, who Lord Mansfield was.
Lord Mansfield was an extraordinary man. He was a prominent political leader, first in the House of Commons, then in the House of Lords. He was Attorney General of England at one time, the Solicitor General of England. He served in the cabinet of the king, and when his time came, he was appointed Lord Justice or Chief Justice of the Court of King's Bench. He is acknowledged as being perhaps the greatest judge the English-speaking countries have ever produced. Was very well known for his sense of fairness, his desire to do individual justice, on one hand. On the other hand, he almost created modern commercial law and insurance law, and he was very supportive of British commercial interests. And he also owned his grandniece. And the way that happened is that his nephew had been a naval officer and had captured a black slave, a female black slave, and had impregnated her. And when the child was born, he didn't know what to do with her, and he basically gave her to Lord Mansfield, his uncle. And Lord Mansfield treated her as a member of his family and indeed raised her along with another white grandniece. And he became very fond of her. And however, he technically owned her.
Hmm.
So this was the man that that Granville Sharp thought was really the focal point of the judicial system in England, and he was the person Sharp was and Sharp's lawyers was going to have to convince to abolish slavery. There was another problem, and that was in the 1720s, almost 50 years before. The then Attorney General and Solicitor General of England had been invited by the planters of the West Indies to Lincoln's Inn for a dinner and drinks. And what they wanted to do, what the planters wanted, was the Attorney General and the Solicitor General to make a statement that slavery was legal, because they didn't want any kind of ambiguity about this, because slavery was an integral part of the economies of the plantations in the West Indies. And obligingly, that's what they did. The Attorney General and the Solicitor General issued a joint opinion saying that indeed slavery was perfectly legal. Now, it turned out that the Attorney General became a mentor to Lord Mansfield, and Lord Mansfield admired him enormously. And so Granville Sharp knew that Lord Mansfield, in order to order the slaves freed, was going to have to somehow find it within him to abandon what his mentor had always believed in and really reverse it. And Granville Sharp had such confidence in Lord Mansfield as a man of justice that he believed that indeed he would be able to do that. In this first case involving Thomas Lewis, Sharp was bitterly disappointed and, of course, became very angry at Lord Mansfield because what occurred was Sharp brought criminal charges against the people who had kidnapped Thomas Lewis, and there was a trial, and at that trial, Lord Mansfield managed to avoid the question of whether slavery was legal in England. And he framed it so that the jury would have to rule that Thomas Lewis had really never been this man's slave, so that because he'd never been the man's slave, Mansfield would not have to rule whether slavery was legal. And then he did something else that really, really enraged Sharp, is that after the jury found the man guilty, the former owner guilty, Mansfield refused to sentence him. And every time Sharp's lawyer would come into court and say, "We'd like to have the man sentenced, we'd like to have the man sentenced," Lord Mansfield would say, "Just go away." And he finally looked at the lawyers and said, "I don't think you understand what I'm saying here. Go away. I never want to see you again." And that's what happened. That I'm sorry, go on.
No. Don't let me interrupt you. You're doing a great job telling story. Go ahead.
Well, then a quite extraordinary thing happened because it was so clear from the way that Lord Mansfield had conducted the Thomas Lewis trial, telling the jury that, phrasing the questions to the jury in such a way that that he would not have to determine the legality of slavery, clearly not wanting to sentence Stapleton, who was Thomas Lewis's former master to jail, and really manhandling Sharp's lawyers, it became clear that Mansfield did not want to deal with this. So on a certain morning in November of 1771, Mansfield finally told Sharp's lawyers to go away and never come back.
And of course, later on, things change with the case of James Stewart, which we can talk about. I guess one of the things that I'm wondering about, and you sort of touched on it, was to what extent Lord Mansfield felt constrained or pressured by the argument that the economy of the British Empire rested on slavery, or at least part of it rested on slavery, and if he, Lord Mansfield, should come along and say, slavery is wrong, it cannot stand, that would be a severe blow to the empire's economy. Was this a case that had a lot of people, both people in business and people in law, and also with the person in the street following it?
Yes, indeed. It was one of the first cases that had an enormous amount of media attention. There were letters to the editor, which was not really a usual thing at the time for newspapers. There were letters pro-Mansfield, anti-Mansfield, pro-Somerset, anti-Somerset. Newspapers in London covered the trial very, very carefully, more than they usually covered things. The trial also lasted, or the hearing lasted, far longer than did the average one. The usual trial in London at the time would last somewhere around 10 minutes. Could be 10 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, but they usually didn't last an hour. And Mansfield, in this case, had the trial last a full 6 months, on and off. So he would say, "Sorry, we're finished for today," after people would argue for hour after hour. "Come back in 6 weeks." They would come back in 6 weeks, and they'd do it again. And they had a half dozen hearings in this case. So the trial was the hearings went on from December of 1771 through June 23rd of 1772, which was quite a long time. And in that time, the media interest became very large, and people began talking about slavery, and they really didn't stop for years until slavery was abolished.
Well, we are at our midpoint of this part of the show. We do have a caller that we'll bring right into the conversation. And again, I'd like to introduce our guest. We're talking with Stephen Wise. He's the author of a book that tells this story. The title of his book is Though the Heavens May Fall, The Landmark Trial That Led to the End of Human Slavery, about the case of James Somerset, took place in London in 1772. And the book is published by Da Capo Press, if you're interested in reading it. And, of course, questions are welcome here. 333-9455 is our number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Charleston. Let's talk with them on our line 4. Hello.
Yes. taking everything that's been said into consideration, my view of slavery is this, that when slavery, human slavery, met the steam engine, something had to give, and a new paradigm was established, and chattel slavery had its liabilities. You know, an investment in a slave, however they were treated and traded around, sold and bought, nevertheless, somebody had to feed them and take care of them and give them some sort of housing and use them in the most beneficial manner to the slaveholder. Well, when steam power came into existence, in my opinion, the need for chattel slavery then was replaced by wage slavery, which still exists to this day. And until something happens to blunt off wage slavery, which will take a huge upheaval in human society, it was inevitable that chattel slavery be done away, because everything changed with the advent of steam power. Would you agree with that, or would you have any comments?
Well, chattel slavery hung on for quite some time. England managed to abolish slavery first through the Somerset case and then through Acts of Parliament at the end of the 18th century and into the early 19th century. But as you know, as of 1860 in the United States, it was a huge industry, and there were millions of chattel slaves in the southern part of the United States. And if there had not been a civil war, they probably would have continued on for some long period of time. And slavery was not abolished in some of the South American countries until near the end of the 19th century. So it certainly was still in existence in part of the world legally for more than 100 years after the Somerset case. Indeed, there is slavery now in some parts of the world, but it is illegal, and it's really not slavery. It's really people being kept against their will illegally in violation of domestic law and international law.
Yes, then there's no comment about wage slavery. I mean, you know, labor is bought and sold just as it always has been. The chattel slave, you know, I reiterate, were a liability. And wage slavery has no liables except when there's enough unemployment and such that we saw the huge upheavals in the 1930s over working conditions and all that's evolved. You know, it's now in a slide. I think there's only 12% unionized workers in the U.S., which, you know, is their power is diminished. But at its peak, you know, the establishment had to come up with some answers, or there was some revolution at hand. Wage slavery... Well, it is what it is, you know. I mean, the only way you can make a living anywhere is to sell your labor. And if you don't have a buyer, then who cares? So thank you, sir, and I enjoy the show, Dave.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Once again, we're talking with legal scholar Stephen Wise. He's written a lot about the roots of Western law, and this book that we're talking about this morning, again, it's about a series of cases that took place in England in the 1770s that really set the stage for the end of slavery in England and then later in America. Though the Heavens May Fall, that's the title of the book. Again, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455.
Well, you may want to know where the title, Though the Heavens May Fall, came from.
Yeah, well, that, I believe, is a quote from Lord Mansfield.
Yes, it is, in the Somerset case. And actually, he'd used it, he used this quote in a case about 8 years before, and he was now to use it again the second time. It was clear that Mansfield did not want to be placed in the position of having to decide whether slavery was legal. Although there was something very odd, that happened, which is on that day in November in 1771, in the morning, when he told Granville Sharp's lawyers basically to go jump in the lake and he did not wish to see them again. That was the very day that James Somerset's case for habeas corpus was brought before him. And he didn't have to issue that writ of habeas corpus, and he must have known that Granville Sharp was behind this too, or he was probably lurking somewhere, and that if he issued that writ of habeas corpus, that the same problem that he had just gotten rid of in the Thomas Lewis case was going to crop up again, and eventually he was going to have to confront the issue of slavery. But he issued the writ of habeas corpus anyway. However, when the case started, he still did not want, if he could, to decide the great issue of slavery. He wanted to help each of the individual slaves. He wanted to bring them out of slavery, but he didn't want to issue the sweeping ruling. And while Granville Sharp and the other lawyers kept trying to box him into it and force him into doing it, so he tried to get the slave owners and the slaves, Somerset and Charles Stewart, to settle. However, Each man, James Somerset and Charles Stewart, each of them were mere corks that were bobbing on an ocean of either abolitionist fervor or anti-abolitionist fervor. And the West Indies interest basically took over the defense from Charles Stewart, and the abolitionists took over the prosecution concerning James Somerset, and everybody wanted this to be a test case, and nobody wanted to settle. And Lord Mansfield tried to get people to settle. He advised the slave owner and the West Indies interest to go to Parliament to try to get a statute passed that would make slavery legal. No one wanted to do it. So finally he said, well, if you're going to make me decide the case, then let justice be done, though the heavens may fall.
It's really a fascinating story, and it does seem to turn on this change of heart of Lord Mansfield, who here we have these two cases. We have Lewis v. Stapleton, and we have Somerset v. Stewart, that seemed in their circumstances to be quite similar. And in the Lewis case, Mansfield, as you explained it, he, even though the jury found the owner, Stapleton, guilty, Lord Mansfield would not issue a judgment. He would not sentence him. He finally, as you say, got to the point where he said to Granville Sharp and his lawyers, just get out of here. Go away. Don't bother me. I'm not going to do it, so just stop asking. And then, of course, again, as you say, the very same day, the next case comes. It was very obvious that Mansfield did not want to be put into that corner of making the ruling, and yet could he not have escaped doing that the second time? Could he not have done what he did the first time around at that point?
Well, he probably could have. He was a very resourceful person. And it's very hard 200 years on to figure out exactly why he ruled as he did. He certainly went back and forth and back and forth. And he clearly did not think that people should be slaves. But on the other hand, he clearly understood that human slavery was very important to the English economy, and he was a very strong backer of British commercial interests. So he was in his mind, obviously, being pulled in several directions. He could have avoided it, and indeed he could have avoided it at the very beginning by not issuing the writ of habeas corpus in the first place, but he did. Then there were a series of very powerful arguments made in his courtroom. At the time, lawyers really did not appear in court very often. It's the 18th century trial was dramatically different than the 21st century trial. And usually neither plaintiffs nor defendants had lawyers. And trials were very short, usually around 10 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes, including the time it took for the jury to deliberate. But this case was seen as so important by the participants that James Somerset ended up having five lawyers, all of whom donated their time, which was extraordinary to have five lawyers in a case. And Charles Stewart had two lawyers. And to Granville Sharp's, you know, horror and fury, the primary lawyer on the master, Charles Stewart's side, was the same lawyer that Granville Sharp had hired to represent the slave Thomas Lewis. And just a few months before, that man, John Dunning, had stood up in the Thomas Lewis case in front of Lord Mansfield and argued that there could not be slavery in England. It simply could not be allowed. Then, within a year, he switches sides and takes the side of James Somerset's master in the Somerset versus Stewart case, and argues that slavery is just fine and is legal in England. And it certainly made Sharp not think any very well of lawyers.
The lawyers, yeah. Well, that's another one of those details that I think is a fascinating detail. And when I was reading this story, I wasn't even sure that I had that right. I said to myself, now wait a minute. Is this really true that it was the same lawyer who argued for Lewis against slavery in that case? In the second case, completely switched sides. In that case, he was representing Stewart, the slave owner. I guess that's what you wonder. How is it that this man, who in the previous case had stood there making the argument for the slave or the former slave against slavery, could then make the argument, represent the complete opposite side, turn around completely and argue for something that he previously, just in a matter of, I'm not sure how long this was, weeks maybe, had argued against.
It wasn't even a year.
Yeah. So it seems stunning that Mr. Dunning, who was the barrister, could have done that.
Well, not only was it did he do that, but he made both arguments in the same room before the same judge, and he made opposite arguments. And of course, there are many people today who don't like that when lawyers do that sort of thing. And John Dunning has been both supported and severely criticized over the centuries for having done that. I would guess the West Indies interest simply made Dunning an offer he couldn't refuse, and they offered him a substantial amount of money, and he took it. And he was the dean of both the common law and the equity bars in England at the time. In other words, he was the most prominent barrister in England. And so it wasn't something that he was going to be able to hide. Here you have the most prominent barrister in England stand up in the Lewis case and say slavery is wrong. Then less than a year later, you have the most prominent barrister in England stand up and say slavery is right. It clearly was not going to be to go unnoticed, and it didn't. He was quite severely chastised for that, and we have a record of what Granville Sharp thought about it. In one of the records I found in the New York Historical Society, Granville Sharp had written in a transcript of the Thomas Lewis case. He'd found the place where Dunning had stood up in front of Lord Mansfield, opened up Granville Sharp's own book against slavery, and was saying slavery is illegal, and Sharp then made a little footnote, and in a fury he was saying, how could a lawyer do this? He is an awful, awful person, and lawyering is an awful, awful profession. He was so angry that he wrote this kind of scrawling on the very bottom and then all the way up the right side of the page. His fury was just spewing out.
Well, let's talk with someone else we have listening. This is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
If it hasn't been covered, I'd like to ask what the reaction was in this country among prominent people, slave owners and otherwise, and in the press. And I'll take my answer off the air, please.
Well, it was a case that was reported by almost all of the colonial newspapers, and the Somerset case had a great impact up until the time of the Civil War. Both the northern courts and the southern courts accepted it as law, as part of the common law that became part of the United States when the colonies became a country. And however the actual holding of the case, which is somewhat disputed actually, but it appears probable that what Lord Mansfield said was that slavery is so odious that the common law, which is supposed to be based upon principles of justice, will not support it. The common law is the kind of law that's made by judges in the process of deciding cases. So Mansfield said, in England, if we're going to have slavery, it's going to have to be through a parliamentary statute. And if there is no parliamentary statute, then slavery is so odious that the common law will not support it. So what happened is that both North and South accepted that. And in the South, the legislatures actually passed statutes that made slavery legal, while in the North they didn't. So everyone agreed that if in the absence of statutes, there would be no slavery. But if there were statutes, and then there were in the South, slavery would still be legal. Then you began to have fights which raged for years and years and years up until the Civil War about the question of things like, well, if you have a slave in the South who then is brought to the North, is he then free because he is now in a place in which slavery is prohibited? And courts began to try to deal with the consequences and the meanings of the Somerset decision in the United States.
So one, I guess, has to be a little cautious about how you talk about the significance of the case, and I think that it is probably correct to say that this decision sets the stage for the end of slavery in England and in the United States.
But it did not
end slavery.
It seems that people argue about whether it ended slavery in England. My take on it is that practically and for all intents and purposes, it did end slavery in England. That is to say that there weren't still a few people who tried to keep slaves, but it appeared that it did, and it certainly provided a big boost for Parliament to act in the coming decades, and then ultimately caused it to end slavery not only in England but in the English colonies, and then ultimately to begin to patrol the coast of Africa to try to stop the slave trade entirely.
Let us talk with someone else. We have someone calling on a cell phone on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, I like to recall that there was I think he was the head of Congress after the Articles of Confederation came out. But he had a son he was from South Carolina, and there's one of the legislators that asked his son, who was studying to become a barrister, to go over and listen to this case. I believe it's the same case. But to me, this seemed like this was really a significant event in the sense that during the Revolutionary War, and I believe this happened before the war, I'm getting my facts a little bit mixed up, but the essence of what I'm trying to say is that based on the fact that England was really, by the Revolutionary War, they were against slavery, the idea that England was going to try to take over more of the governing powers in the United States, which was, I think this could have been an idea that maybe the United States was quite afraid of having England, with their view about slavery, getting more involved in American politics. I'd like to hear your comments on this.
Well, actually, just before the outbreak of the American Revolution in the mid 1770s, when war was clearly coming, the governor of Virginia famously said that any slave who joins the British Army will be free. And kind of turning the rhetoric of the colonists on its head, the colonists were talking about liberty and freedom, and yet they were keeping slaves. And people like Samuel Johnson in London said things like, isn't it odd that the people who yelp the loudest for freedom are slaveholders? And slaves indeed did think about and did take the Virginia governor's statement very seriously because they knew of the Somerset case, and they knew that that the British were freeing their slaves in London, and that if they could make their way to London, they certainly would be free. And if the British governor was going to proclaim that they would be free, well, maybe he knew what he was talking about. And consequently, there were numbers of slaves who deserted their white masters on the American side and went to the British side in exchange for promises of freedom. And they believed that because of the Somerset case.
Well, my point is that isn't perhaps that slavery might have been, or the fact that the England's position on slavery might have been more of a significant cause for the Revolutionary War than we'd like to admit.
It's so complicated there. I don't know the answer to that question. Certainly, the thing that I immediately thought of was the fact that in one of his earlier drafts of the Declaration of Independence, one of the things that Thomas Jefferson was railing about was how the British had imposed the system of slavery on the United States, and then the Continental Congress deleted those phrases from the Declaration of Independence. So I think one problem is it was really hard to talk about the colonies as a unit, because the way that the people of Massachusetts viewed slavery and the people of South Carolina viewed slavery were very different.
Well, my point is that I think this is just another issue that has never been brought up very much, the fact that the South would, which there was a lot of loyalties in the South, but maybe they felt differently, knowing that England, if they were going to be enforcing their rule in the United States, perhaps could either tax for slaves or just do away with slaves, and this would frighten the Southerners tremendously.
Well, you may have a very good point.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. In the Constitution, there was a provision that set a deadline for ending the importation of slaves. And that was when the Constitution was created. It said, "Well, 20 years from now, where there will be no more importation of slaves." That was 18. That would be 1808.
Yes.
In 1807, the British formally abolished the slave trade with their colonies. Was there some relationship between this step, that is, in the United States, in the early United States, to say that at a certain point we will no longer import slaves? Is that somehow related to the Somerset case, or generally the abolition movement in Britain?
Probably it is somewhat linked. The issue of how all the colonies and then the United States viewed slavery is very, very, very complex. I have many, many books in my library on it. And one thing I did mention is that within the United States, people within colonies and then from colony to colony had very different views about slavery, and it was something that clearly had to come to a compromise. And indeed, one of the many compromises, you know, is famously set forth in the Constitution, where for certain purposes, black slaves are counted as 3/5 of a person. I mean, obviously, that was compromise.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm remembering this right, it was one of those important things that was offered to the Southern states to get them to ratify it.
Yes, indeed it was. If I may say something,
yes,
that is some people. Indeed, I was on your show, when I talked about my book "Rattling the Cage,"
yes.
Drawing the Line, because I'm primarily known as an animal rights lawyer and animal rights law professor and legal scholar, and there is a direct analogy between the work I do on behalf of the legal rights of non-human animals and the work I've done on the Somerset case.
Well, that, I guess we're almost at the point where we have to finish, but that does invite some kind of way to wrap us up, to talk about what is your feeling is the larger, the lasting significance of this case that we've been talking about.
Oh yes, and one of the important issues that I have dealt with in the last 20-25 years in the issue of animal rights law is what is the legal process, or what is the process by which a being who the law views as a legal thing without any rights, essentially invisible to the civil law. What's the process by which that being can then, through the judicial process, become a legal person who has at least some fundamental rights? And that was really the text of Rattling the Cage and Drawing the Line. And one of the reasons that I wrote Though the Heavens May Fall was to go back to a time in which black slaves were seen as chattel, as things, the way non-human animals are seen today, and to look at the whole, you know, unbelievably complex, fascinating, messy process by which black slaves in London, through the judicial process, moved from becoming a legal thing without any rights to being a legal person with rights.
Well, I think at that point we will finish with the suggestion that for people who are interested in reading this history, they can go and look at the book that we have been talking about. And again, the title is Though the Heavens May Fall, The Landmark Trial That Led to the End of Human Slavery. The publisher on the book is DeCapo, and the author is our guest, Stephen Wise. He's taught at the Harvard, Vermont, and John Marshall Law Schools. He's also president of the Center for the Expansion of Fundamental Rights, which he founded in 1995, has written a good deal, articles and books on the roots of Western law, a book that, as he mentioned, we discussed here on this program that looks at the law and animal rights. That book is entitled Rattling the Cage, and then also this book, both of them available in the bookstore if you're interested in reading more on those subjects. And to you, Dr. Wise, we just want to say thank you very much for giving us some time today. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you for asking such terrific questions.
All right. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Our show, Focus 580, is also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Coming up a bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn, the host, in her 1 o'clock interview, will take a look at the editorial cartoon in the American press. She'll be talking with Chris Lamb. He's professor of communication at the College of Charleston. He's the author of a book entitled Drawn to Extremes, The Use and Abuse of Editorial Cartoons. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the show. During the noon hour, Ed Kieser, our chief meteorologist, will have the latest on the weather. He'll also be taking your phone calls. If you have plans to do some traveling over the next few days, you can talk to Ed and he'll give you a forecast for your destination. That's the Afternoon Magazine. Gets underway here at noon on AM 580. Celeste Quinn is the host. In our next hour, we'll be talking about tsunamis and earthquakes, what it is we know about them, how they're caused, and whether or not in the future we can predict them. Our guest will be Brian Atwater. He is a geologist. He teaches at University of Washington, so he'll be joining us by phone. Right now, though, we'll break for an update on the market. Stay tuned.